Thank you, Bruce. Good afternoon to all of you. Great to be here. Mr. Benedict mentioned any eventful things going on in your week. Well, I didn't really have any eventful things, but I know this coming week, Kit and Eric, Eric and Kit, are 30 years they've been married. On the 12th, is that right? 30 years. So you might want to ask them some of their secrets. How do you do it? It certainly was an interesting Passover. A betrayer and symbol with new meaning. Even while they were eating, Jesus took bread and gave thanks. And then he broke the bread and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And then they sung a hymn and went out to the Mount of Olives. Across the Kidron, the brook, and the Mount of Olives, outside the city, there's a garden. It's called the Garden of Gethsemane. Its name derives from the oil press. It was a place in which olives were pressed. And the pressure there would cause the oil to be expressed out of the olives. And Jesus met here often with his disciples. If you want a title for today's message, it's "What It Meant to Him." What It Meant to Him. If you turn to Mark chapter 14, Mark chapter 14, because this passage, like no other, shows us what it meant to him. And it is a stunner. As we primarily deal with this, and we look at it, and we see what it meant to him, in the end, we will transition to what it means to us. Let's draw near to the Garden of Gethsemane. Let's draw closer. Let's see what's happening in the garden. Let's understand what it meant to him. We're about to tread on holy ground. Mark chapter 14 and verse 32. Then they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took Peter, James, and John with him. And he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." And he went a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." And then he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." again he went away and prayed and spoke the same words. Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. If possible, take this cup from me. But not my will. Yours. Yours. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to say to him. And then he came a third time, and he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise. Let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." As we overhear Jesus' prayer, it helps us to listen for what it means to him. What it means to him. You can keep your finger in Mark, in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 7. Hebrews 5 and verse 7. It says, "Who in the days of his flesh," speaking of Jesus Christ, "when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears." With strong crying and tears unto him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard in that he feared. Jesus is about to die, and as a man, he needed divine help. He needed divine help. Barnes' note says, "with strong crying." This word does not mean weeping as the word crying does for us. Rather, it means an outcry, the voice of wailing and lamentation. It's the cry for help of one who is deeply distressed or in danger, and refers here to the earnest petition of our Savior. He needed divine help. Now, what's interesting about the narrative in Mark is that it most likely came from Jesus Christ himself. The source of this narrative was likely Jesus Christ. Because as you heard, the disciples were asleep. They kept falling asleep. They could not stay awake. And they may have heard him in the distance, his lament and his cry and his anguish. But they did not understand it. They did not grasp it. And yet they should have. They could not stay awake. Mark is telling us what it means to Jesus Christ. What did it mean to him? It meant being abandoned by all. It meant being abandoned by all. He was going to do this alone, and he was going to be crucified alone. Everyone would leave him. Everyone. Notice verse 27 of Mark 14. Verse 27. "And Jesus said unto them, All you shall be offended because of me this night, for it's written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered. But after that I am risen, I will go before you unto Galilee." Verse 29. "And Peter said unto him, Although all shall be offended, I will not. And Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, that this day, even in this night, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he spake the more vehemently, "If I should die with you, I will not deny you in any way." And likewise, all the other disciples said the same thing. Verse 32. And they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. This place of the pressure. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took Peter and James and John with him. And he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. And then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. Stay here and watch." And he went a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." And then he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed and spoke the same words. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to say to him. They were asleep. At the arrest of Jesus, all the disciples abandoned him. Verse 37, they were sleeping. Verse 40, they were sleeping. Verse 41, they were still sleeping. And then, they desert him. They abandon him. William Lane's commentary on Mark, under the heading "The Prophecy of Failure and Denial," says, "By locating this episode between the prophecy of desertion and its fulfillment, Mark emphasized that Jesus had to face this hour of crisis alone. Jesus was going to face this by himself. They would desert him. They would leave. They would sleep. And when he was arrested, they fled, every one of them. He was going to do this alone." Notice what Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 3 says. Isaiah 53, verse 1, "Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him." He was going to do this alone. No one else could do it. When I think about the times of my greatest aloneness, there's only one or two or three times in my life And one time, I remember being in Big Sandy, Texas, and I got a call that my dad had terminal cancer. It was in his colon. And he didn't have very long to live. And I remember that night going out of Booth City so sorrowful and walking outside of Booth City, and there was a ditch that was near the airport. I fell in that ditch and I cried to God. I felt so alone. I remember praying to him. I said, "Father, if you can take a year off my life and give it to my dad, please, if you would do that." And yet at the same time, at times when I've been alone, I've never really been alone. I was always able to come back and talk to someone there. I always had a family member I could go to. I always had someone in the church I could go to. I was never alone. No one has been alone like Jesus Christ was here. No one. He was going to do this all alone. All would abandon him. All would leave him. All would walk away. He had to do this alone. Isaiah 63 and verse 3. The first part says, "I have trodden the winepress alone. And from all the people, there was no one with me." No one was with me. The anointed one of Israel was going to be wholly abandoned by them. There was going to be no human being there for him. He had to be an atonement all by himself. This is entirely the work of the Messiah. What did it mean to him? It meant great and exceeding sorrow. It meant great and exceeding sorrow. Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him a little closer, you'll recall. They probably were taken because of their great self-confidence. You'll remember, "Peter, I won't deny you. I would never do that." Oh, they were arrogant. They were full of themselves. "I'll never deny you. I'll never run from you. I'll never walk away. Though all others deny you, I won't do that." And the sons of Zebedee, remember James and John? They come up to Christ and they say, "Hey, in your glory, give us a seat on the right and the left." And Messiah says, "That's not mine to give. Can you drink of the cup that I will drink? Can you be baptized with the baptism that I will be baptized with?" "Yes, we can." What self-confidence. What arrogance. What misunderstanding. To not comprehend what was going on. And now we come to the Garden of Gethsemane. And we see Jesus Christ, quite different than what we're used to. Prior to this point, he'd been healing the sick, taking those with leprosy and touching them, forgiving sin, raising the dead, casting out demons, calming storms, and walking on water. He confronted the religious authorities of his day. He overturned the money changers, remember? And ran out all the animals. He was dauntless. He was fearless. Our Messiah. But we come to the Garden of Gethsemane and we find a Messiah that we're all too unfamiliar with. He is stunned. There is fear. There's trepidation. All of this, it's a Messiah we're not used to seeing. Mark 10, verse 32. Mark 10, verse 32. An interesting verse because it says, As they came into Jerusalem, Mark 10, verse 32, they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. He wasn't afraid of death. He was leading the way, and the disciples must have looked at him and said, "This is utter lunacy." That very verse, it says, they were afraid because they knew that it was certain death to go into Jerusalem. He was hated and despised. But Jesus was leading the way as he set his face toward Jerusalem. And they were amazed and afraid. He wasn't fearful over the prospect of death. That didn't shake him. And there's no sign of sorrow for him at the Passover. He gives thanks, and then they sing a hymn. Verse 33 of Mark chapter 14. And he took Peter, James, and John with him. And he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. And then he said unto them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death." Stay here and watch. The suffering here is forcefully stated. It is one of profound disarray. One translation says that he was in shuddering horror. Shuddering horror. This time in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was troubled to the point of death. To the point of death. He almost died right here in the Garden of Gethsemane. Something Jesus saw, something that he felt, something in the garden caused this unshakable Messiah to be shaken. In Luke 22, verse 44, we find Luke mentioning that Jesus is under such great stress that he perspires profusely. And Luke records that his sweat became like drops of blood falling on the ground. Back to Mark 14, verse 35. And he went a little farther and fell on the ground. He could not even walk. He was exceedingly sorrowful. And he fell on the ground. And he prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. He was horrified at what he saw. This shook him to the very core of his being. And he prayed in verse 36, "Daddy, Daddy, Father, all things are possible for you. Please take this cup from me." The cup. The cup. What's in that cup? What's in the cup? "Take this cup from me." In Psalm 76, verse 7. Psalm 76, verse 7 says, "You alone are to be feared. Who can stand before you when you are angry?" Who can stand before this holy Father when he is angry? In Psalms 90, verse 11, "Who knows the power of your anger? Even according to your fear, so is your wrath." Psalm 75, verse 7. "But God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. For in the hand of the Lord, there is a cup." There is a cup. And the wine is red. It's fully mixed. And he pours it out. "Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drain and drink down." The cup. In Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 15 through 16. "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me. Take from my hand this cup, filled with the wine of my wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. And when they drink it, they will stagger and go mad." What's in the cup? Peer over the rim with me. Let's look in that cup. It's vile. It's got a horrible stench. That cup has all the sins of the world in it. Those in the past, those in the present, those in the future. All sins are in that cup. But that's not the only thing in the cup. What else is in the cup? The holy, righteous wrath of God towards those sins. That's what's in the cup. The sins of the whole world and God's wrath are in the cup. It symbolizes the judgment and the wrath of God against sin. And that cup, in Revelation 14, chapter 9 and 10, or verses 9 and 10, it says, "If any man worship the beast in image and receive the mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God." That's what's in the cup. Jesus looks in the cup. He staggers. He falls to the ground. And he says, as he prays, "Abba, Daddy, please, if there is any other way, take this cup from me." "Not my will, but your will be done." He's horrified at what's in the cup. His desire to find another way, an alternative, This aversion is not an unwillingness to save us. It's not that. His reluctance is not that he wants to disobey the Father. It's not that. He's not questioning the will of the Father. It's not that. His aversion is to the horror of God's wrath against sin when he's looking into the cup. And it leads him to the deepest of sorrows, where he falls to the ground and he says, "I am at the point of death in this garden. I'm about to die." It almost kills him. The tide of history is now upon him. And he's so affected and grieved to the point of sorrow that he's seized with anguish and trembling and collapsing and sweating profusely and fainting, almost dead from sorrow. He's on the ground and he's praying, "If it's possible, please take this cup, Father, from me. Please take this cup from me." He had prayed to the Father 3 times, this same prayer. 3 times. But the Father was silent. And that silence, to me, it's deafening. It's deafening. We read of nothing that says the Father spoke and said, "I'm with you." We don't see that. The silence is deafening. And yet at the same time, you know for certain, if it was possible, if there was any other way, any other alternative, any other way to do this, you know the Father would have given it in that instant. But there was no other way. There was no other way. In effect, the Father not answering was saying, "You pray your way through this one. You pray your way through this one." Just like Jesus had asked the disciples, "You watch and pray because there's a crisis coming. You pray your way through this one." And it's almost as if the Father said, "They will abandon you. They will leave you. All the disciples, all the nation, all will leave you, and you will be alone. And I will abandon you too, son. I will turn my back on you, son." He was going to do this alone. R.T. France states, "The scene in Gethsemane, with its extravagantly expressed emotions, thus offers a powerful new insight into what it meant for Jesus to face up in practice to the fate that he had so long predicted as his divinely appointed calling. His agonized plea for some other way reveals a deep inner revulsion at what was to come. But even now, he looks for only what is possible within his Father's will, and the ultimate, 'Let your will be done,' assures the reader, there is no other way." The Son had to be like us, and he had to be unlike us. He had to be like us in flesh, in humanity, but he had to be unlike us. He had to be a God. He had to be both. And he said, "Not my will, but your will." Instead of saying, as the first Adam said, in effect, "Not your will, but my will," he was saying, "Not my will, but your will." And he resolves here to drink of the concentrated essence of the full fury of God's wrath. And he takes this cup and he drinks it. And it's got dregs in the bottom of it. The dregs are the most bitter part. And he resolves to drink it all of it, every drop, every single drop. Ron Rhodes writes, "Christ had to be a man so he could die in man's place. If Christ the Redeemer had been only God, he could not have died, since God by his very nature cannot die. It was only as a man that Christ could represent humanity and die as a man. As God, however, Christ's death had infinite value sufficient to provide redemption for the sins of all mankind. Clearly, then, Christ had to be both God and man to secure man's illustration or man's salvation." I read illustration there, and that's because I wrote in my notes, if for some way I could illustrate this. And I thought about it and thought about it. There is no illustration. If I gave you an illustration, then you might think you actually understand this, the depth at which he went through. You might have something to identify with and to hold on to and say, yes, I understand this. There is no illustration for this. It has to be given in its raw form. He was going to do this alone. He was going to take of the full fury and wrath of the Father. He was going to drink that cup dry. Every last drop. Every last drop. He had resolved to drink the cup that all of us, the elect of God, would have to drink personally if Christ did not drink it in our place. This is the humanity of Jesus on full display. And he lays aside his perfection, his sinlessness, and as a result, we have just witnessed the greatest act of obedience that the world has ever known. "Not your will," the first Adam said. But the second Adam said, "Your will be done. Your will be done." Notice with me 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 21. God, it says, has made him, that is Jesus Christ, who knew no sin, to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. Galatians 3 and verse 13. Galatians 3 and verse 13. Paul writes that Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. By becoming a curse for us. For it is written, "Cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree." He wasn't hanging there for his sins. He was hanging there for mine and for yours and for all the world. Isaiah 53 and verse 4 through 6 says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace." We gain peace because of his turmoil. because of his sorrow. He was chastised for our peace. And by his stripes we were healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one his own way. And the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. All of us. I think of the wounds of Jesus Christ. They started in the garden. And you can't understand the wounds of Christ and what he went through unless you understand what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane. It interprets the crucifixion. There's a poem by Edward Shalito. It's called Jesus of the Scars. He says, "The other gods were strong, but you was weak. They rode, you did stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak. And not a God has wounds, but thee alone." Not a God has wounds, but thee alone. And by his stripes are you healed. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. Galatians 2 and verse 20, well-known passage, because there's been a great exchange that's taken place. Galatians 2 and verse 20, "I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me." There's been a great exchange. My alienation became his alienation. My shame became his shame. My curse became his curse. My deserving chastisement became his chastisement. My sins become his sins. His relationship with the Father is now possible for me. There's been a great exchange. His righteousness becomes my righteousness. His peace becomes my peace. His life becomes my life. And his death becomes my death. My grief, my sorrows, my deserving affliction, my iniquities, he became sin for me. And therefore, Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Read with me Romans 8 and verse 1. "Because of this, therefore, there is now, at the present time, now, there is no condemnation for those who are in Jesus Christ." If you are in Jesus Christ, if you are in fellowship with Jesus Christ, if you were baptized and you are connected through the Spirit with Jesus Christ, there is no condemnation for you. We cannot even begin to understand the crucifixion until we understand what took place in the Garden of Gethsemane. What did it mean to him? It meant total and complete abandonment. What did it mean to him? It meant a great and exceedingly sorrowful person, a human being, and a God that we sinful human beings are just incapable of fully understanding. Let me close with a reminder as we transition to what it should mean to us. William Lane, in his commentary, writes, "The dreadful sorrow and anxiety then out of which the prayer for the passing of the cup springs is not an expression of fear before a dark destiny, nor a shrinking from the prospect of physical sufferings and death. It is rather the horror of the one who lives wholly for the Father at the prospect of the alienation from God, which is entailed in the judgment upon sin which Jesus assumes. The horror thus anticipates the cry of dereliction in chapter 15 and verse 34. Let's read that. Chapter 15 and verse 34 of Mark. This man was not afraid of death. But that cup, it shook him. Mark 15, verse 34. "And at 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?'" D.A. Carson writes, one of the great English hymn writers was William Cowper. Cowper was a brilliant scholar who wrote distinguished critical essays for the students of Oxford and Cambridge. But in his distinctively Christian work, he combined with his friend and pastor John Newton, who wrote the song Amazing Grace, to compose and publish hymns of great depth and power. But people sometimes forget that Cowper wrestled with deep clinical depression all his life. He attempted suicide several times. 4 times he was institutionalized for long periods in an insane asylum. And each time he was released, he was nursed back to health and strengthened by a kind Christian woman in the church which John Newton pastored. About a century after Cowper's death, the great poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote a 3-page poem entitled Cowper's Grave. In it, she describes the extraordinary influence of Cowper's scholarship, his hymnody, and his personal piety. And then she begins to allude to his horrible dark nights of the soul. And then, powerfully, referring to Jesus' cry of desolation, she writes the poem, Cowper's Grave. "Yea, once Emmanuel's orphan cry this universe has shaken. It went up single, echoless, 'My God, why am I forsaken?' It went up from the Holy's lips amidst his lost creation, that of the lost no son should use those words of desolation." Do you hear what the poet is saying? Do you hear that? She's saying that those words that Jesus cried out, "My Father, why have you forsaken me? Why?" It's because he didn't want William Cowper to have to say those words. He doesn't want Sam Sweat to have to say, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He had to do this alone. And everyone was going to leave him. And he did it because he did not want you to go through that. He did it for our survival. He did it for our life. And it was a great plan that the Father had, and it was the only way. And the Son said, "I will do it.
I will do it. I will drink that cup dry. It's now the cup of peace, a cup of salvation, a cup of thanksgiving. But for those failing to examine themselves, it is a cup of judgment. It is a cup of judgment. Read with me 1 Corinthians chapter 11. As we close here, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. In verse 27. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and the blood of our Lord. Therefore, a man ought to examine himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body of the Lord eats and drinks judgment upon himself. Those are strong words. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. In verse 16. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one loaf, we, who are many, are one body, for we all partake of the same loaf. What happened here in the garden interprets what happened on the tree. In this garden of Gethsemane, it was so costly, more costly than we can imagine, more costly than we can fathom. It was exceedingly painful, even unto death. My dear brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, I hope that you will never look at what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane quite the same way. In some way, I hope you can see what he was doing there. Why? Why? And if we have not been moved by peering into the garden and what happened there, then God forgive us our dry eyes. This should move you. And not a superficial moving, not a shallow moving. Unless you understand what happened here, you can never understand what happened there on that tree. This is what it meant to him. And now I ask you, what does it mean to you?